Creative Frequency, the voices of creative arts therapists around the globe. I'm your host, Alex Chu. I'm delighted to have a special guest today for this inaugural podcast. And without any further delay, let me introduce you to the illustrious Dr. Sue Jennings, the grandmother of drama therapy. And what an apt title to encapsulate her enormous contribution to the discipline of drama therapy in UK. My own memories of Sue stretch to the very early days of my own drama therapy training at then the Hertfordshire College of Art and Design in St. Albans, where Sue was leading us through a Michael Jackson's Thriller dance routine as the course tutor. Dr. Sue Jennings has pioneered drama therapy and play therapy not only in UK and Europe, but also in many countries across the world, including Greece, Norway, Denmark, Switzerland, Italy, and more recently Kosovo, Slovenia, and Macedonia. Her career path spans nearly half a century, which have included roles from educationalist, actress, broadcaster, writer, researcher, and many more which I'm sure to have missed out. Sue considers herself retired from active engagement from clinical practice and teaching, although it might be a misnomer, as she is active as ever and I imagine will remain so. I give you Sue Jennings. Good morning, Sue. May I make a start? Yeah, it has been 5 years since your official retirement. How has this latest rites of passage been for you?
Well, people talk, or I talk, about being retired, and I've just decided that you retire in lots of different ways. And I think what I've really retired from is institutional restraints, when I've been working for institutions, where I don't seem to have retired at all, because I'm working as much as ever.
That's why I thought. You're as busy as ever.
But what's very nice is that I have so many more choices now. And one thing about getting that little bit older, you lose your fear of being rejected or not listened to, and it gives you a lot more courage. I'm enjoying being in my 60s immensely, and I find I have more energy than I used to have rather than less. And because I know, or I feel I know, that there are some fundamental truths about this type of work and how it can make a difference to people's lives. And you know, people will write and tell me things about how something has worked really enormously well in their groups or with an individual. And at the end of the day, Alex, I feel, I mean, it's not my work. I mean, I'm just a channel and a way of expressing it, perhaps in a different way. Because I don't think at the end of the day, drama therapy is anything new. We're just putting it together in a different way. The ancient truths from storytelling and theatre and ritual that have been known for a very long time.
In terms of this phase, as say this phase in your life, has it actually been influential in the direction of your focus in drama therapy work? I was just thinking more particularly about more ecological issues and things like that.
I think now to put drama therapy work within the total context of the environment and within the socio-political field, put it within peace studies, for example. I mean, now that action methods, which of course are one of the cores of drama therapy, are using far more in social education, it's much easier now to be able to make those links. Because at the end of the day, if an individual is at peace with themselves, and at peace with the people around them, they will be at peace with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite certain that's not just the inner world, it's also the outer world.
And is this something that's also reflective of where you are at the moment? I suppose generally in terms of developmentally too, as we get older, these issues become more focused in our mind. Is this something that you ascribe
to? Indeed.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think one can talk about drama therapy in a pod, so to speak, in a capsule or all on its own. It doesn't have relevance to everything going on around one. And, of course, England was very different in wanting to make all the arts therapies very separate and very discreet.
Mm.
And even at universities where there's art therapy, music, drama, dance, movement therapy and so on going on, they do maintain a very separate ingredient there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right from the word go, I have always been an advocate of some integration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying a total integration, because I do think we have different ways forward depending on our skills and experience, whether we are more drama people or more art people or more music people, more movement people, as you know, which I've developed very much in my EPR development.
Uh-huh.
So it can come together, but I think there is some separation.
Uh-huh.
Having said that, I don't think any country has worked sufficiently to find, well, what are the points of integration?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 20 years ago or more, I was proposing an integrated foundation year for studies.
Yeah.
And nobody anywhere would take that up. They'd say, oh, no, you know, if you're going to be an art therapist, you must just do this. If you're going to be a music therapist, you must just do that.
That's right. But when... I suppose the integrationist approach is also been reflected in other fields too, because of the interdependency, you see. Like you find in other disciplines like counselling and psychotherapy, there's also a call for more integrationist approach, you see.
More integration, more dialogue, more mutual respect.
Mm.
And for me, one of the saddest things is when it all becomes territory to be competed over, rather than a common goal where we each have a slightly different path but meet up at the same place.
Yeah, and somehow also, I can't help but thinking whether it somehow resonates to... as we approach this phase in our lives, you see, we tend to reflect that thinking too, you see. You know, as we get older, as you were saying, see, we tend to put together, review things that we have been through and say, make more sense, making the links more often.
Indeed. I mean, the one thing that... partial retirement gives one anyway is more thinking and reflecting time, and looking at how do things come together in a different way, for example. And always the creative process brings about new ideas. And once the creative process has started, you can't then just stop it and say, well, this is it, because it's like with the evolution of theatre in any one decade. The whole range of interpretations of old texts and stories and myths and legends, whatever, come together in a new way, new languages, new approaches, and that's also fed by the audiences or participants themselves, isn't it? So it's a continuing organic evolutionary process. And I think the organics of the creative artistic process isn't always addressed in the therapies. We tend to end up with some fixed techniques. You know, that these are drama therapy techniques and these are music therapy techniques, and you know, drama therapists don't dance, they play roles. And I think it's very restricting and very counterproductive and often very unhelpful. I mean, I've had a 30-year relationship with my art therapist colleague in Norway, for example. And she and I work every year on art therapy and drama therapy as an integrated approach. It will absolutely be clear what we ourselves do. And that has been such a fruitful partnership. working like that.
Yes. Some would say that it may be in any kind of in looking back, you see, in any kind of development of a particular profession, discipline, they tend to reflect the kind of development the individual go through too, in a developmental way, in adolescence, about how to need to make oneself distinct in this identity. Then as you get older and you're more mellowed, and you tend to be more integrationist. Is this something where the profession is going to, you see? You know, when we first started in drama therapy, maybe we need to make a distinction, you see, before we come to the point where we can integrate, isn't it?
I think that's very true. I think that's very true at one level.
Uh-huh.
But what I think happened was that when the arts therapies changed from being a practice to a profession,
uh-huh.
I think there was far more separation,
uh-huh.
and there was far more competing for jobs, for example.
Mm.
And I don't think that was necessarily a healthy development.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still unclear in my own thinking whether the arts therapies should be professions or not.
Mm-hmm.
I still think they should be postgraduate trainings, don't get me wrong. But whether it's a postgraduate training where you end up as a very professional practitioner, or whether you end up as having this separate career,
mm-hmm.
I'm not too sure. Because, mm-hmm. as we know, one of the difficulties anyway is enough jobs for people as art therapists.
Yes.
And in terms of, you know, status and pay and things like that, it's still difficult, isn't it?
Mm. This is the main issue for the organization too, you see, and getting more opportunities for jobs and things like that. Mm. I was just wondering, do you think those two can sit together?
Well, practice and profession.
Yeah.
I don't see why not, providing, again, that there is more dialogue between them all. You see, what's very interesting in other countries, for example, in Ireland, where I work, and also mm-hmm. in Israel, is that they actually have a professional body for all the arts therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And in Israel, it includes psychodrama as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they all have their own group within, but because it is one organization, there therefore has to be dialogue, because they all belong to the same umbrella, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we are all very entrenched in our own professional bodies.
Mm.
Ideally, I think before arts therapies and psychodrama and play therapy should be able to come together in some type of organisation. But I'm not sure whether that will happen. I really feel strongly about play therapy there too, because after all, play therapy is the foundation for understanding all the arts therapies, if we look at it closely.
Yeah, and like they are operating in the involvement, in the involvement as a distinct practice and profession and things like that. And I suppose I wondered, the thought that's crossed my mind has with the industrialization, you see, about how to split into so many parts that sometimes it lose the connection. You see, the more we split, then the more we probably unable to see the link and interdependency of each other. And,
don't you think it's rather like also understanding the peace process? That when one's in conflictual situations anywhere about anything, globally or locally, it's always talking about difference,
That's
and
right.
overlooking the fact of what is actually common to all.
That's right.
And what is undoubtedly common to all the arts therapies and psychodrama and play therapy is this core of creativity that starts at the very beginning of life. You know, I've written a lot about creative and playful attachment and demonstrated how the early relationship is a playful and creative one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, that's where it all starts. And as a child grows and develops, then some leaning or being drawn towards one form of expression rather than another mm-hmm. becomes apparent.
Mm.
But there is a commonality there at the beginning.
Yeah. So maybe you can call it meta-process or meta-theory that underpins.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the first 18 months of life, certainly, a child demonstrates what I call proto-art, proto-music, proto-drama, proto-dance.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an art form in itself, but you can see the roots of it there. As you say, it's like a meta-experience that becomes crystallized a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Can I ask you then, in retirement, is it what you imagine it to be? Because I'm approaching that myself. I was thinking, you see, I wonder what it's going to be like.
There was this idea, well, if I'm going to let go of that and let go of that, it gives me more time for this and more time for that. Yes, there were quite a number of closures of various things, and certain jobs where I felt there had to be an awful lot of compromises.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying I wasn't true to myself, but I had to give a lot of ground in order to take something one step forward,
mm-hmm.
for example.
Mm-hmm.
Institutional constraints, and sometimes people finding it very difficult to have somebody with a lot of energy and a lot of new ideas around them. So this tendency to try and put me in a box or label me or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Being able now, having closed all those areas, to be able to respond to really very exciting new ideas of work that I hadn't considered before.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I'm doing a lot of work in the social theatre area, because all the social theatre people who were working, particularly in war-torn societies, realise that drama therapy has got a part to play in all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be travelling to one or two danger spots over the next 12 months, working with people who are working within the war-torn society.
Yeah.
And that is really a challenge because one's making it culturally specific on the one hand and not offending sort of local sensibilities in relation to gender, race or whatever. But it's a way of bringing what my drama therapy freshly into a different type of situation.
Yeah.
Because I think so often in the clinical setting, therapists get very interned on themselves and within themselves, that everything becomes about the inner life of the client.
Yeah.
And it often can lose its cultural context, which, as you know, is why I did anthropology in the first place. So that's one exciting thing about my retirement. Another is the freedom to have more choices about what I want to write.
Yeah.
And also to have more choices about my travelling, which is very exciting. Because up until recently, the travelling's had to be, you know, in the academic breaks or when something can stop before something else has started again.
Yeah.
And being away for any period of time has always been difficult.
So it's
Peter and I are now beginning to travel the Silk Route. And this
year we went to Kyrgyzstan
and Kazakhstan.
That's
and
fantastic.
Again, taking some drama therapy there, which was very exciting. But also collecting stories that the old traders used to take with them. So there's a different type of travel now.
I hope you're going to write that up for us.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. That will become a book of a book of travelling tales, that will be. And,
so you're going to back where the profession started, like the travelling vagabonds, yeah, as you were mentioning.
Well, I did a very early article, didn't I, about the strolling players and the vagabonds. And, I still have this image, and if we use a theatrical image for a moment, that when drama therapists get nervous about being drama therapists and at the margins, they do all sorts of classical training, like psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, to, as it were, become center stage with more security. Whereas I think sometimes by staying at the margins and by being the vagabond, by being the peddler, by being the traveller, the stroller, whatever, one has the possibilities of working with people in quite different ways.
Yeah.
It's the difference between being the hero in the myth and being the trickster in the myth.
Yeah, that's about to say that, yeah.
trickster energy is very important for drama therapists.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I think them being the fool, you see, enable you to be in that kind of marginal space upon which you can observe and comment as well as, you see, participate.
And make an input when it's appropriate.
Yeah. And so, in a way, you see, you have been able, in the role of retiree, you've been able to write your own script, you see.
And absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, one thing, talking about my own script that I'm working on at the moment, Alex, and again, this will be published within the next year, because you know that I went back into professional theatre in the early 90s, which was, well, two reasons, really. Partly it was following the breast cancer, which, luckily, there was an early intervention and I'm fine. But also that thing, well, when you have a diagnosis like that, is your life going the way you truly want it to? Also, I lost a job at the time. We're from, should we say, medical doctors who didn't like my success, put it that way. And all of it made me have a real time of reflection of where was my own creativity in theatre in this process. And so I became quite resolute, and I rejoined Equity, I found myself an agent, and I started working in theatre and a small amount in television and film as well. Now, one of the things that I was doing in theatre was developing a one-woman performance.
Yeah.
And it's only now, looking back on the one-woman shows that I did, which started off with this traditional midwife who was prosecuted in 16th century for witchcraft.
Witch hunt, yeah.
And then Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who was the very first lady doctor. And then Rosalind Franklin, who helped to discover DNA, but had some of her ideas taken from her. And then, excuse me, and then it was the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. And then it was a one-woman show called Spiral of Madness about three generations of women who had got mad on their medical records.
Yeah.
Right. And finally, The Wife of Bath, which is a very funny, bawdy comedy. And it wasn't until very recently I realized how my own life had been woven through these one-woman shows.
Yeah.
And actually they in themselves were evolutionary. So that my own therapeutic process was happening in quite an extraordinary way through those performances. And I think this is something really important to write about, because these were one-woman plays performed for professional audiences. The idea that they were therapy for me didn't enter into my thinking at all. Do you think that's an interesting sort of journey there?
It is, and this is one of the things that is also been inputted into a lot of drama therapy training about using your own material to do an autobiographical piece or performance.
Sure, but that is very much a conscious process.
Yeah.
Well, for me, this was supposed to be me back in the professional theatre.
Yeah. But the question is about conscious, unconscious always bring me to the question of synchronicity, you see? And I think is that any timing when your sensitivity, with towards the synchronicity, it brings about, you see? Events that has got so much potential meaning, you see, that enables us to move towards what is really there. And like I said, I'll bring to the next bit again, to be able to follow our bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say, you see, eventually, you see. And I think what you you have just expressed there. I only hope that this is something that people then can go back to use it as a potential kind of a grid or reference, you see, to be able to plot their own processes, you see, towards their own therapeutic processes about their own evolution in their own psychological and spiritual development.
And what was so interesting, you see, was that all this insight came to me unasked for.
Yeah.
It was, you know, waking up and thinking, gosh, my God, that's actually what happened. Rather than me trying to make meaning happen, trying to interpret what I had actually done. I wasn't even particularly thinking about those shows until in a time of quiet reflection about something else, it came just literally unbidden. And then I could actually see this evolutionary journey. And of course, one of the pioneers with me, Gordon Wiseman, had quite a role to play in this, because he very astutely suggested that I did The Wife of Bath, this bawdy comedy of this elderly woman who'd had the five husbands. I mean, because the Spiral of Madness play had really taken me to the edge of performance. You know, going mad three times a night and having electric shock treatment, etc. And I was quite stuck where to go next in performance, in theatre. And Gordon rang me once at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, why don't you do The Wife of Bath? And he was absolutely right. Again, I'm quite sure that his suggestions weren't based on any deep conscious analytic, but more an intuitive, creative theatre process.
You also address quite a lot of social issues down there. You know, with women issues, gender issues, and people can identify strongly with feminist issues, as well as, you know, the put it that way, the misogyny in quite a lot of the institutional frames like mental health and things like that. So in some ways, it's quite political too, is it? Social-political.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we always need to go back to the fact that theatre itself is subversive. That whatever play is being performed, what is the meta-performance? And if we look at the strong and vigorous theatre anywhere in the world, it has this subversive element to it. Whether it's whether it is to communicate something, or whether it's to explore something, or whether it's to resolve something, it always has that dimension if it's vibrant theatre, and I think that is so important. And my concern would be if drama therapy ever gets so embedded in clinical practice and in psychoanalytic, psychotherapeutic ideas that it loses that creative theatre base. Because it's quite interesting how some therapists have quite strange ideas about actors, for example. I was once approached by an analyst who had an actor coming for therapy. I was just an advisory role. I wasn't in a supervisory role. And this particular individual said to me, "So why are actors such difficult people?" So I said, "Tell me more." And he said, "Well, he keeps cancelling his appointments." So I said, "Well, when do you see him?" He said, "Well, he has my first appointment in the morning at 8 o'clock." So I said, "Well, have you ever considered what time actors actually go to bed?" And he said, "What do you mean?" So I said, "Well, if they're acting in a show for at least 11 o'clock at night, and then by the time they've unwound and actually got some equilibrium and actually had their evening meal, it's probably 1 or 2 in the morning. Are you surprised?" And he said, "Well, I still think he's avoiding something." I said, "Well, look, try rescheduling this performance to something else."
Yeah, and then you can make a decision. Conclusion.
It's this, what shall I say, mystery that therapists have about performers.
Mm-hmm.
But equally, in some ways, some performers have about therapists.
Mm.
If they understand what they're doing too much, they will, you know, some actors believe if they're ever therapized, then they will lose their creative spark, rather than being able to enhance their creative spark. You know?
Mm.
So I think both professions have an ambivalence about each other. And I think in drama therapy training, they're somehow trying to reconcile that ambivalence. And I think generally they do it very successfully. Because once a drama therapist gets really analytic, they are analytic drama therapists.
Yeah.
They're psychotherapists who make use of drama.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to stay as what I call a true drama therapist, as a theatre-based therapeutic practitioner, is actually very difficult once you have chosen to go down a psychotherapy path. But as you know, that's my personal view.
Uh-huh.
I'm not suggesting all drama therapists believe the same as I do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very valid view. Is the question arises is that how do you bring about a certain sense of balance between those two processes, you see? The question is that could it only be dependent upon maturity, or could it be engineered right from the very start, you see? Would you more likely to see this happening and after somebody has matured, after they've been through those two ends, you see, to be able to bring about balance, you see? And that maybe it's a developmental thing, you see? And sometimes, because I also noted, you see, from supervisors when they first start in the profession, they tend to get very pedantic about, you know, and semantic about certain things, you see. But as they mature, the capacity to encapsulate more and more into their actual work and to live it, you see, is become more apparent, you see. So sometimes, no matter how much we wish for, you see, in the beginning, sometimes you just have to depend upon the process to mature itself, and then probably you see what you just described coming more closer.
I think you're absolutely right, because I think the whole evolution of therapy itself during, you know, this part of the century has been an interesting one. At one point, you know, Freud and Jung and the others were absolutely at the margins. You know, this wasn't science. This wasn't medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, they've now what I call again moved to center stage.
Yeah.
Whereas in the early beginnings, they were very much at the margins.
Mm.
And of course, I think with our fascination, you know, society's fascination for how people grow and develop and what makes them tick.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes people do certain things is very much a preoccupation.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's partly the luxury of having more leisure time to be able to do that, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, when you're tilling the ground like the Temiya in the forest, and it's day-to-day survival, you don't have quite so much time for such speculation, do you?
Yeah, and that's the subject I'd like to bring in too, because I gather that you are returning back to that phase in your life, or going back to visit your adopted family. Is that
absolutely
right?
Yeah, later this year, 2007, we're going back to the forest, to the actual area where I and my family lived, and I and my older son, who's kept in touch with the Temiya quite regularly, we're going back there, and we're going to stay there, and they're going to create some of the rituals that we know from old, the traditional singing, the storytelling, and the trance dancing.
I hope you are making a record of that, are you? With some full affirming, or have you bringing the crew with you to do any of those?
We shall actually film it while we're there, and we shall write about it while we're there and record. We didn't want to bring anybody else in there because it could be quite off-putting for them.
Yeah.
But essentially, it's a family occasion.
That's right, yeah. But also, and family do keep family albums and family videos.
Yeah. But one reason I suddenly decided, right, we've got to do it now, is that several of the older people that I knew very well have now passed on. And there's a wonderful woman there who is the chief midwife in the area, and it was she that asked me to be her midwifery assistant in the village. And she's very old, and she's quite frail, and she's going blind, and I thought, if I do nothing else, I must go and see her, because she was a great influence in my life. I mean, the basic truth that came out for me in terms of my drama therapy work, I mean, one always had from her when she said, would I be her assistant? And I said, but look, I've never delivered a baby before. And she said, well, you've had three yourself. She said, of course you know what to do. The idea of it being based on experience, you see. And something that I think we're not good at in Western Europe, and that is really understanding preventative medicine and preventative therapy. And the Temiars have a very clear notion of what you do to keep not only the individuals healthy and strong, but also the community healthy and strong. And that's through certain sorts of the trance dancing. And, you know, they would just explain to me, it keeps us well. And there were other sorts of rituals that they would do if either the village or individuals in the village were unwell.
The social...
So this idea of preventative and curative mental health being so well understood, I thought was quite remarkable.
And I would imagine, because being your student, this was something that influenced towards your thinking about the evolution of drama therapy too, is it? From the social
media. Yeah. I mean, I think generally we don't pay enough attention to preventative mental health, and the whole way it can operate in education either. Because, you see, if you think about it, say in schools, in secondary schools, when it's time for exams, what are the things that get cancelled? But the drama class, the art class, the music class. When those could be the very things actually managing the stress. That people taking exams or being tested have to undergo, but we don't recognise the value of the arts as primary forces in our society nearly enough as many non-Western societies do. So I mean, I think in Western society, it's not just art therapies; it's also the arts themselves that still have to spend an awful lot of time being recognised, because now that there's funding and now there's more technology and now you can watch a drama class on television rather than doing a drama class with a drama teacher. Other choices have been made, haven't they?
Yeah. So it must be difficult too for you in this trip going back to visit the family, because with the I mean, that must be how many years? And you're thinking about 30 years now, isn't it?
Yes. Since I've been there, it's almost 30 years.
So the
And I mean, what's going to be incredible is that I'm going to see babies that I delivered who have now become parents. And that is going to be quite extraordinary.
It will be extraordinary too, from what you, from the point you have said, you see, because of the balance of the in studying them and the contribution they made, you see, towards some of the your thoughts. But the society also must have changed too, become, because as they become more westernized in terms of Malaysia, that must be quite a difficult balance to maintain.
I'm very aware, Alex, that I will be in for some shocks. I mean, luckily Andy has been back and has met them and has sort of reported back to me, so to speak. But I know they have become more westernized, and many of them have technical and electrical things now that they wouldn't have had when we were there. However, I also know that there are many of them who still insist that they live in their bamboo houses near the river, and won't become an urban sprawl. So I think I'm going to see a balance. I'm going to see a people in transition, but I think we will still see some of the original traditional ways of life. But it will be really interesting to see, well, what things have changed and what things haven't. Because, you know, all sorts of anthropological studies have shown that when people are exposed to, for example, you know, more technology in their lives, would they actually want to sort of go and earn more money? And, I mean, not everybody does. So people spend more time in sport and leisure rather than in, you know, the money-earning work ethic. So it'd be quite interesting to see just evolutionarily where the Temiya are now in their whole attitude towards life and living.
I'll be looking forward towards your observation about them in the transition that...
And of course, if you remember, one of my very important observations was the whole non-violent, if you like, peace maintenance, which of course has come full circle for me in my other work.
That's right, and I can't help but thinking too, in the work of people like Carl Rogers, when he brought his ideas to encounter groups and dealing in war-torn areas and conflict areas. It's like you bring in drama therapy in into those areas to make a difference.
And I think that is something about getting to my age too, that one becomes concerned about the wider context. Yes, I mean, I think your suggestion of a child adolescent adult model in the evolution of drama therapy is actually quite interesting, and I think it's absolutely right. And I think where drama therapy is probably in young adulthood at the moment, as it's moving forward into greater maturity.
And I like the title, you know, which is in the website, The Grandmother. Not by coincidence.
It was quite interesting that people referred to me as the mother of drama therapy. And I said, oh, no, not the mother, maybe the grandmother. And that sort of stuck, you know.
Yeah.
And I love the role of grandmother, both in real life and in drama therapy.
Yes, and I like that image too, because there's a distinction between mother and grandmother somehow.
And it also carries something with it too, that one has lived long enough to have an opinion about something.
But what I call more sedate sort of opinion, like not kind of on your face sort of thing. It's like kind of the wise woman at the back sort of thing, see?
Of course, it fits in very much with, again, with the Temiya, that age is respected. That they would always ask an older person, and sometimes people would say, well, what can they know about it? They haven't lived long enough. And they would sometimes say that about Malay officials coming in to tell them they should be doing this and they should be doing that, you know. And after these officials had gone, they'd say, well, what do you know about that? They're not old enough. And these were people, say, in their 20s and 30s.
I know. You know, I'm delighted to see that whilst you are there, you're going to offer some of your time to conduct drama therapy, play therapy workshops in my hometown of all places, Penang.
I'm so excited about doing that.
I know. But I just wonder, I know it's difficult, but given the opportunity that if there was one thing that you'd like to convey to a to an audience that's at the beginning, if you think back again 30 years, if now they have had the opportunity to look back about the evolution of drama therapy and play therapy, now I'm in a audience who are at the beginning, if there's one message I'd like them to think about as they proceed to take on this discipline to become therapists of the future in Malaysia, what would you like to convey?
I'd like very much to convey to the Malaysian audience that they are already, without realizing it, creative therapists in their own way. that all I'm going to be doing is bringing out what they already have.
Mm-hmm.
Because people forget that each and every one of them actually is a creative person.
Mm-hmm.
They don't always consider what they're doing is creative, but they all have that there. And for some people it's untapped, for some people it's channeled in particular directions. And what I hope I shall be doing is building on something that people are already good at and already mm-hmm. specialist at. But it's not me telling them what to do. And within this very rich, diverse culture in Malaysia
mm-hmm.
that encompasses so many traditions and practices and religions and rituals and belief systems and dance and puppetry,
mm-hmm.
it's there.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is actually helping them to think about it perhaps in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the thing is, as we were just discussing early on, you see, given the fact that you can recognize this, is there's a clamor for some kind of, you know, the Western profession to get it rubber stamped, to get discipline out of it, to get it recognized, to get it introduced into clinical situation, into
mm-hmm.
in a social situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that's where they might be looking for ideas from you. See, how did you develop it from, from what is already there, even here in UK,
yeah.
to be part of the health professional council recognition of being a discipline in its own right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. And I mean, one thing I know has already happened in Malaysia
mm.
is a recognition of the role of the traditional healers.
Uh-huh.
In terms of the Pengulus and the Bomos,
they are bringing that into the to be monitored, you see, so they can
become part of it. Consulting them and having conferences with them, and that's beginning to include the Orang Asli as well,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a very big step forward. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? The Kren be an integration of the old and the new.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't just have to dismiss something because it's seen as primitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that's very important to be able to explore in a sensitive way is the fact that people are ambivalent about new ideas. On the one hand, they're excited and energized, but on the other hand, they're quite scared they might take over and people might be marginalized because of these new ideas. And so there's often an attempt to try and control these new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And say, well, only psychologists can do therapy.
Mm.
That's what's happening in Romania at the moment.
Mm.
Or only this profession can do that. And that's always been the case right over time. I mean, even at one time, certainly here, only doctors can deliver babies.
That's
male
so.
Doctors at that.
Mm.
And the midwives were all stopped, for example. And so I think it's a question of getting a dialogue going and for people understanding. And I can do that in even a little exercise sitting in the chair of remembering when you were last playful.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn when you were being playful?
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly people will think, yes, that's absolutely right. I did understand that in a playful way rather than in a purely writing bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see my point?
Yeah, I do. And given the given the kind of huge and wide diverse experience you've got helping other parts of the world setting up the practice inverted commas of drama therapy, do you see that possibly ever occurring in Malaysia? Maybe drama therapists. Inverted commas, a role of drama therapists, or maybe for a different, better word, given the fact that you're more inclined towards a more integrative sort of creative arts therapist, as a possibility of supporting a development as such in a place like Malaysia?
Well, I'm thinking that your ideas about having an integrated approach. Is one really worthwhile exploring.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Malaysia is rich in is cultural and artistic diversity. And I would want to be extremely careful, particularly in Malaysia, that I'm not seen as a cultural imperialist imposing a Western model on them anyway. But to be able to have an overall approach of the creative arts and therapy, I think would be a very interesting thing to do, and something unique for Malaysia. And why shouldn't they have a unique model? I think your idea about a creative arts therapy approach is very different from the expressive therapy approach, say of Leslie College and so on, where it's to do with expression. I think that it is more rounded and more resolved in a creative arts therapy approach, and then people having choices about the type of intervention they might make. And yes, you will get some people who want to use more art or less drama or more music or whatever, but they will all have had a thorough grounding in it all, right?
Yes. And this is one of the things too, because there are a lot of community artists, you see, there's a lot of social artists, and they're really doing a lot of what I call non-governmental work on the ground, you see. I think that is a large part of society, which they can even make a more active contribution in sharing with the other people who are working in the clinical field, like therapists, doctors and nurses and OTs and things like that.
Yes, and I think it's something about finding the role for the community artist as perhaps being able to become a community artistic therapist in some shape or form, that they're not controlled and seen as having less status than the clinicians. That's probably a difficult one. But I think we must be careful that they're not sort of invited into the hospital setting in an inferior position.
I think that even taking lessons from where we are at, even at this point in UK, where user involvement and user group and user empowerment is critical, and where community should be the core of any kind of intervention. And I think this is something I see as a potential model, you see, to introduce right from the start, because we had the unfortunate thing where we dichotomize, you see, the profession from the community. This is the nature. Okay. Yeah.
I've got something to offer in this whole area, Alex, that perhaps we can talk about again. But I really see now that the arts therapist has a very important contribution to make at what I call a tertiary level. Because we tend to think that the primary level is to do with the medical consultant referral, don't we?
That's right.
And that the secondary level is to do with the psychological intervention that probably happens within the hospital. But then the tertiary, which can happen in the community, could act early. It could be like an early intervention when it could be seen that people might be at risk of hospitalization. And that the community arts therapist could be working within the community in a preventative role as well as a therapeutic role. I mean, if someone was deemed to need therapy but not hospitalization, that's again where they could be working, isn't it?
That's where the diversity that I suppose in a way I'm thinking about, because sometimes we get too isolated in thinking of just hospital clinics, you know, this kind of outpatients, in terms of how it could have developed. But beside that, can I ask you, is this something that you could see yourself going back to Malaysia to support such a program or such a training initiative?
Oh, indeed.
Yeah?
Yes, I mean, I've already talked about it with Peter, and he'd love to come with me probably next time.
That's great.
and to, because you were talking about probably sort of once a year, weren't
yeah.
you? And do intensive training and then have that backed up
by blended learning with the new use of technology where it has been successfully implemented, you see.
Well, too, and I mean, one can do supervision and seminars through webcam anyway.
That's right.
So one could have distance learning for a lot of things.
Sue, I'm aware I'm taking a lot of your time, which I'm delighted, and I just wanted to sum up by some of the things that I would like to ask. You know that just before we started, I was just Googling, or Amazoning, Amazon, and they have 23 of books of yours, either as an editor, writer, you know. May I ask if you got any thoughts for listeners of any future books that you are on the shelf at the moment or on the boil at the moment that we could look forward to?
Right. Well, I'm just bringing together an edited volume,
uh-huh.
which is just called Drama Therapy and Social Theatre.
Uh-huh.
And I brought together a group of international drama therapists and international social theatre practitioners.
Uh-huh.
And we're looking at the complementarity between all these disciplines and where different people work. So that should be out next year.
Uh-huh.
I'm also
publishers.
That will be Routledge.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm also writing another book for SpeechMark on creative play with babies.
Uh-huh.
Well, creative play and storytelling with babies, really starting from pregnancy through to sort of 4 years old.
Really?
Yes. There's an important role of creativity there.
I look forward to that one.
That's SpeechMark. The book that will be out by SpeechMark at the end of this month is Creative Puppetry with Adults and Children at Risk. And that's been very joyous to write about, both making and using puppets in therapeutic settings or special needs settings. So those are well on their way. Now, I'm hoping to bring together some of the stories now, the ones I'm gathering on the Silk Route and so on, in some shape or form, probably in terms of, you know, storytelling for therapists or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But I'd also like to do some books for children on particular stories I've come across that are that bit different. I'm involved in creating a handbook that's going to be translated into Romanian for Romanian practitioners, because I'm working a lot with the Department of Child Protection there, with care workers that worked in the former orphanages who really have very basic training, and I'm producing materials for them. So yes, I'm doing a lot of writing, and you know, I'm hoping next year I shall have more time for what I call fun writing.
Yeah.
Of just sort of pursuing creative ideas. And I think I'd like to write a book about all that's happened in Romania itself. And that might be followed by one that's all that's happened in Malaysia.
So it's a balance between two things, isn't it? One more on the kind of overview and kind of heavy discussions, but on the other side is more the other more very useful, practical, tangible. You know, which a lot of people are going to find very helpful and supportive in terms of the work they're doing. Is it?
I mean, I think that's probably something I've got some skills at. People say that reading my practical books is like having a lesson with me.
That's right.
I write as I talk, and they find that helpful.
And we are very clear, I must say, very, very clearly laid out and things like that. Mm. In terms of it has a resource and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? May I make a request for a book sometime on drama therapy and conflict mediation or peace work or drama therapy and ecology or green therapy is what you mentioned. And maybe your ideas on that.
I mean, maybe that would be one integrated book. Drama therapy, mediation, and the environment, something like that.
Yeah.
But, yes, I mean, I think I think a lot of work has been done on action methods and the use of role play and games in the peace process and in conflict mediation. I'm not saying anything terribly new. I might be taking it a step further. But, you know, I've discovered quite a lot of literature in that. I'm part of an EU project producing materials for secondary schools with virtual role plays, which it's still in its first year, so it's still forming. But there are five countries working together on producing role plays that have got conflicts in them, say bullying and intimidation, and then looking at ways that a mediator can work with that. So that's quite an interesting thing.
Yeah.
For me, very new technology, working with Second Life and, say, the virtual world, quite unknown.
Have you set that up yet in Second Life, using Second Life to convey anti-bullying?
I haven't got my own space in Second Life, but this project has. And it's not public yet because it's still being written and designed. You know, each country, for example, produced five role plays. So we've got 25 role plays that are now going to be refined and made ready for the idea is secondary schools right across the world. Do you use Second Life yourself?
I do, because as you know, my interest has been into technology, see, because I do a lot of online therapy, and at the present moment also online art therapy using images, role playing and things like that.
Actually use therapy in Second Life yourself?
Not in Second Life myself, but this but I'm thinking about that. I'm using in whiteboard, use a whiteboard, you know, for a lot of the arts therapy.
Well, maybe that's a whole area, Alex, we could talk about.
Yeah.
Because I would certainly be interested in finding ways to make that more accessible to people.
Yeah, I love talking about that. I'm just aware of the time, you see, and I did say I don't want to take too much of a time, because I did say we're going to take an hour on that.
But that's okay. But I mean, I think Second Life and those sort of developments is a separate conversation for us. Yeah.
Yeah. May I invite you back to our podcast, Sue, in the future? Would you be willing to give our listeners the benefit of your presence again in the future podcast?
Oh, sure, if it would be helpful.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. We're going to have more conversations, and our listeners will be looking forward to hear some of the things that we just touched on this morning, you see.
Well, let's see what the feedback is from the first one.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe there are points in this one that you or others would like me to pick up on, but then there's maybe some future developments, like the Temiars and developments in Malaysia and the Silk Route and things like that, that could be developed and talked about in the future.
I'll mention that to our listeners, so do keep feeding the comments, please, and tell us what you think. If there's any area that you're interested in, please do send them into the podcast site. We really appreciate, don't we? If there was anything that I haven't asked as yet for this morning, our inaugural podcast for Creative Frequency, Sue, should I have asked you anything that maybe I've forgotten?
Well, I think overall, Alex, your questions have been very far-reaching, and I think they've had the breadth that is needed. And I suppose I would like to just sort of finish the presentation coming back to these ideas of being able, one hopes, to take a process of the democracy in therapy, that everyone has this potential, everyone has the potential for creativity and artistry. Like the Temiars, you see, told me that everybody has the potential to be a shaman.
Yeah.
It just is whether you choose to be, not that you can't be. And I think that idea that everyone has the healing and artistry within them is really, really important. And how do we find ways of people making that accessible for others as well as for themselves?
I concur, particularly in this day and age with in democracy and things like that. I really would like to thank you very, very much, Sue, on behalf of myself and the listeners, for a very enjoyable and a very interesting interview today.
Thank you.
And I hope you return soon again and offer our listeners further thoughts that you might like to share again in the future.
Another installment.
Yeah, please. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, bye bye. You have been listening to Creative Frequency, the voices of creative arts therapists around the globe.